You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Live across Wisconsin on Civic Media, you're listening to Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, powered by Up North News. Now, from our Lake Wissota studio, here is the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Hey, good morning. It is 8:06. It is nice to have you here back up north on this Monday morning, September 29th, 2025. Parker Olson producing things down in Madison at Civic Media Headquarters, Studio A2. Coming up later this hour, our friend author Laura Bird will join us to mark this week's annual Day of Remembrance and Reconciliation about Native American boarding schools and several books that touch on that particular sad chapter of American history. We'll be hearing from Jane Matinere later this hour about what she and Greg Bach will have on Matinere on Air starting at 9 o'clock, and that will include your next chance to win in our Go for the Green and Gold Text to Win contest. And the news headlines today, the former state, I always want to say Commerce Secretary, but it's now the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, former Secretary Missy Hughes announced this morning that she's running for governor. So she joins a crowded Democratic field of candidates to succeed Governor Tony Evers in the 2026 elections. If you missed it late Friday, there were some other 2026 candidate announcements. Bill Berrien got out of the governor's race, the Republican businessman, and Democrat Laura Benjamin dropped out of the race for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District. That leaves two other Democrats, Becca Cook and also Emily Berge from the Eau Claire City Council, is still racing to have one of them take on Republican Congressman Derek Van Orden. There's a lot of motivation to take on Derek Van Orden and to unseat him from the 3rd Congressional District, not only for votes that he's taken that will be hurting farmers and frankly, anybody who needs health care in the 3rd Congressional District, but he has been undergoing what could quite accurately be described as a new Red Scare in this country. In the wake of the Charlie Kirk murder, there were plenty of people, myself included, who said that this was a true tragedy, that this should not have happened. But let us not sugarcoat who Charlie Kirk was, what he said, what he stood for. And I'm going to be first in that parade of people to make sure that we do not lionize or turn into a martyr this person who should not have been a victim, but we're also not going to sugarcoat who he was. A lot of people made comments to that effect, and Derek Van Orden and many others held them up for targeting, for threats, for doxing, and there have been, at this point, hundreds of people who have lost their jobs simply for expressing their points of view on the Charlie Kirk murder. One of those people no longer working in the job that she thought she was secure in is Krista Lasecki, who had been teaching in the Ellsworth School District until a few days ago. She's one of those people that Congressman Derek Van Orden chose to single out, and it unleashed some a certain segment of the population, and Krista is no longer in a classroom doing the work that she does best. And she joins us now to tell us more about the experience. Krista, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. I appreciate your willingness to join us at what is definitely not an easy time for you, but you were teaching high school math in Ellsworth. Tell me about your teaching career, how long it lasted, and what all you've enjoyed doing.
This was my 32nd year, and I felt like as excited about it as I had in the beginning. I just love teaching, and I love teaching math because kids don't hate math. They just hate feeling dumb. And so that was my job, to make them know that they're not dumb.
And it's something that, again, you've been doing, this was what, your 32nd year, you said, of teaching?
Yeah.
Third year in Ellsworth. And I'm betting that you did not start any social media accounts like just yesterday. You've been on social media for some time. You know how it works.
Yes.
Okay. So you put things out there and people, you know, don't always agree with what you have to say, but that's the nature of social media is you say things and people comment back and forth. So let's get to the specific events following the Charlie Kirk murder. You know, tell us about, you know, what it is you posted, and then what was your first indication that things were not going to go the way that, you know, they typically do on people's social media posts?
Well, the night that he was murdered, I was watching the news and, you know, scrolling on social media, and I was just getting caught up in the frustration of sanitizing this man's life because of the way that he had been murdered. And it was not my finest moment, but I quoted him and his belief that some gun deaths are okay because they protect the Second Amendment. And I regretfully said that that you can't be upset about this because he fulfilled his destiny. So it was not my finest moment, but I had quoted his exact words. And then that Friday morning, I got a call from administration on the way to school at about 6:15. And then by 10 to 8, I was told to go home.
What did they tell you? And let me back up a second, sec, that you have reached a separation agreement with the school district. So there are probably things that you can't talk about, but from a general standpoint, what is it that got you in trouble?
Well, I'm honestly not exactly sure, only because it was a post that was done at night on my personal computer, on my own time, on a Facebook account that did not say where I worked. But the administrator that spoke with me just said that it had caused a firestorm, and that was it.
Was there anything in your paperwork with the Ellsworth School District or any of your other teaching jobs that said anything about foregoing your First Amendment rights to free expression when you're not at work?
No, I did have one person, thank heavens, shout out to Tiffany, who said, don't ever put where you work on it. Mm-hmm. Because
but it turns out you didn't have to, because there were other people who were willing to do this, not to mention your congressman. When were you first aware that Congressman Van Orden had been part of the quote unquote firestorm?
Honestly, it wasn't until I had a meeting with the district that I was made aware that he had threatened the school district's funding and the city's funding.
And I want your reaction to that. When you heard that a member of Congress had looked at your post and threatened to cut off funding to the city of Ellsworth and or the school district, what did you think about that coming from your congressman?
Well, he's not my representative.
Okay.
But I was shocked because the comments from people who disliked what I had to say were, you know, she's a danger to be in the classroom. But if he thought that I was dangerous, what does he think defunding schools is going to do? Like, that hurts the entire community. And if he really is concerned about Ellsworth, then that's not the path to take.
Yeah, I'm not really hearing concern from him about Ellsworth or education. He's somebody who's threatened to defund federal funding to the entire Mayo health system, which serves countless people, you know, in and around your area and all throughout his particular congressional district. So did you feel when, again, the words that were used, like, you know, domestic terrorism and threats and everything, did you feel that those might have been a bit overblown?
A bit is an understatement. I mean, I'm not I'm not glad that Charlie Kirk was murdered, and I'm not happy with the way that I worded that. But I'm not a danger to students, and certainly a larger danger is to defund, you know, medical systems and school districts and cities in general.
We're talking to Krista Lasecki, former teacher in Ellsworth, about comments that, you know, she and many other people made about Charlie Kirk, and many other people have found themselves either without a job or facing the threat of unemployment as a result. Now, in your case, I mean, this has happened. This damage has been done. There, there's the possibility of legal action, perhaps. But for now, what has happened has happened. I've talked about the backlash to the backlash, that there was all this, what I want to say is emotional rhetoric from people like Derek Van Orden and others. But in the wake of what has happened to you and others, I feel like there's been a backlash as well, saying, hey, you're fine to be angry. You're fine to want to defend Charlie Kirk. But this whole thing, getting people fired, attacking the First Amendment, attacking funding, you know, is beyond the line. Do you sense that as well, that there is a growing backlash to the people like Derek Van Orden, or are you more concerned that this is a new normal in America for a while?
Well, certainly that's a concern of mine. But I think that there is definitely a grassroots movement to unseat people like Van Orden, who think that he should be able to squelch the First Amendment from his seat of power, which is the definition of, you know, my violating my civil rights.
Is that something that you think may, you know, the violation of your civil rights is something that may, you may choose to go forward with?
I really haven't, you know, gotten there yet. I'm still reeling from having to clean out my classroom yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, 32 years of teaching and, you know, deciding where you go from here, is teaching still something that you have a desire to do, perhaps not anywhere near Derek Van Orden's district?
I love teaching. You know, anytime that I can get into a classroom is going to be a plus for me, but I can also, you know, help kids by tutoring, or even just subbing in a high school allows me to have access to, you know, helping kids. So that's my goal, is to somehow continue to connect with kids and math in specifically.
I don't doubt that you will, honestly, in some ways that, you know, again, good people, good teachers, find that path forward. I have the utmost confidence that you're going to find that. And frankly, I think you're going to find a degree of justice as well. It won't be easy. And it is honestly a damn shame. It's an American shame that, you know, a teacher in the United States has to go through this. But I do appreciate you telling us about it and for sharing your story. And I hope that you will keep in touch with us, Krista.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Krista Lasecki, former teacher now in the Ellsworth School District, visiting with us this morning. It's 8:19. When we come back in about 15 minutes or so, we'll be talking to author Laura Bird about book recommendations for a different kind of dark chapter in American history, and that deals with Indian boarding schools and the ravages that it brought to children here in the United States. I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Now, I regret to tell you that Derek Van Orden is still doing Derek Van Orden things. I took a look at his Twitter feed during the commercial break here. And again, continues a stream of insults and threats and things that are not true. For example, we have the potential for a government shutdown in less than 48 hours now. And it is Republicans who have the majority in the House of Representatives and the Senate, and they control the White House, and frankly, they control the U.S. Supreme Court too. And yet, here's a recent tweet from Derek Van Orden saying that the Wisconsin Democratic Party and Rebecca Cook are demanding the government shut down unless you pay for illegal aliens' health care, genital mutilation surgery for children, and Medicaid fraud. Let that sink in. This is what we are fighting for. We are fighting for sanity. That's a post from Derek Van Orden, a member of Congress, who, again, is in the majority. They have the votes to pass whatever they want to pass. You just saw it just a matter of weeks ago in the big bloated boondoggle, the thing that includes massive cuts to health care that are coming. The things that they want the cuts to health care. It pays for tax cuts for the very wealthy and blows up the deficit, the thing they used to say they were so against. But now, even with the votes to pass something, they can't vote to pass a new federal budget. It's one thing to pass a bill that does all kinds of cuts, but a federal budget does so much more. It funds the entire federal government. It determines the taxes. It determines the spending. It determines the priorities. And Republicans are in the majority, and yet they can't agree amongst themselves on a budget. So if they want a budget, if they don't want the government to shut down, they're going to need at least some Democrats to come along with them. They could negotiate. Here's where Democrats started with negotiations. You want our votes? You pull back on some of those healthcare cuts. Pull back on a bunch of those healthcare cuts because it was stupid. And you guys did it. And you guys are in the majority. So if you want our votes, you're going to have to start there. Well, President Trump canceled a meeting last week with congressional leaders and took a much more combative stance and instead said, well, we don't need you. And we'll go ahead and shut down the government, which will send a whole lot of non-essential employees home. But you know what? We're actually going to do more than that, the White House said. And we're going to do even more layoffs than what is necessary. We'll do firings. In other words, they're holding federal employees and the federal government hostage. And what do we know about Donald Trump and congressional Republicans? They will always shoot the hostage. And they're saying, here's the thing. We're going to keep shooting the hostage. We're going to make the shutdown stretch out and let the hostage bleed and deny government services to more people. Our military is going to go without pay. TSA agents are going to have to go without pay. When they decide they don't want to work and not get paid and they call in sick, it's going to result in delays in air travel, processing of new Social Security applications and Medicare applications, confirmation of information for you to get a mortgage if you were buying a house, all of these things. And Republicans are good with that. Rather than agree amongst themselves, because again, they have the votes, they have the majority, but rather than agree amongst themselves, they've put out this fairy tale that by Democrats not giving them the extra votes they need, and not negotiating with Democrats to get those votes that they need, that somehow the Democrats are the bad guys in this. The one thing the bad guys, the Democrats, don't want is for people to go without health care and for government to shut down and for vital services to have longer waiting times and more inconvenience. And they're banking on that. They're hoping that public pressure somehow goes on Democrats to say, save us from those Republicans, save us, give them the votes, give them whatever they want so that they stop harming the hostage. And so, like it or not, what you're going to see in the United States starting this week for the foreseeable future is a messaging war. Whose fault is this? Is it really Democrats who are at fault if Republicans don't mind that the government is shut down? Because that's what they're going to try with garbage tweets like what Derek Van Orden just put up there, saying that somehow it's Democrats' fault. And what they'll do is, rather than talk about all the basic services that I just laid out for you, they're going to talk about illegal alien health care and genital mutilation surgery for children and Medicaid fraud. They don't believe any of that for a moment. These are folks who are very happy shutting down the government so that, again, all that savings can go to cut the taxes of their wealthiest donors. They love to talk about how, well, we, you know, some of those health care cuts to the Affordable Care Act were subsidies, and those subsidies were helping the very rich people. Like, you could have, what did one of them say? Something like a $600,000 annual income and still qualify for Obamacare subsidies. Technically true. If you had 25 children, and if every one of those children were on an Affordable Care Act health care plan. Since when do Derek Van Orden and other Republicans suddenly care that wealthy families would be able to get help affording their health insurance? So yeah, they're going to try to sell this as some kind of fraud, waste, fraud, and abuse, these health care cuts, because a few people with higher incomes might actually get a break on their healthcare costs, which frankly, almost all of us need. And they'll throw things out there like illegal alien healthcare to try to scare you that somehow the $1 trillion that they've cut in healthcare is going to undocumented immigrants' healthcare. When it's not, you know that. Most people know that. Most Americans know that. It's just a matter of whether they care enough to say out loud what they all know. Republicans are perfectly fine shutting down the government and hurting Americans and trying to blame anybody else but their own incompetence. They have the votes. What they don't have is an ability to govern. Back after this. I'm Pat Brightlow. You're up north. The decision by Congressman Tom Tiffany to run for governor means there will now be an open race for Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District, which takes up a good chunk of the northern third of Wisconsin. It was represented by Dave Obie for 40-some years, Sean Duffy after that, and Tom Tiffany currently. But with him running for governor, it opens it up with Republicans and Democrats talking amongst themselves about who should be running and who could serve as the next member of Congress from up north. One of the people who's been doing a lot of talking about that, a lot of traveling, connecting with people, is actually a former legislator from the Baraboo area, but who relocated to northern Wisconsin a number of years ago. And I mean, if you want to know about the North Woods, you got to talk to a guy that really knows woods, and nobody knows the woods like Fred Clark. He is a senior forester. He has served as a senior forester with the Department of Natural Resources, as an ecologist with the Nature Conservancy. He's been a consulting forester. He has served on the Wisconsin Council on Forestry, the Wisconsin Council on Tourism, briefly on the State Natural Resources Board. He knows a thing or two about how to make sure that the North Woods is good for business, is good for tourism, and is good to our resources. And maybe it's time that the North Woods is good for representation in Congress as well. So Fred Clark joins us now to tell us more about what's happening in the 7th. Fred, good morning. How are you?
Morning, Pat. Really good to see you. It's a wonderful morning here in the fall in North Woods.
It really is. And so, I mean, nobody understands the task ahead like you, and I'm sure that other people have expressed interest in this as well. But where did you ultimately come down on your own decision about what to do in the 7th District?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. You know, I spent a good part of this summer with some friends just traveling the 7th Congressional District. And as most of your listeners know, it's a huge district. This is about a third of Wisconsin, our entire North Woods, parts of 26 counties. And we just wanted to, after talking among ourselves and following all of the drama coming out of Washington, we just decided to get on the road and try to put a pulse on what people were thinking about and talking about. We went to Marshfield and to Wausau and Merrill and Tomahawk and Rhinelander and Hayward and Spooner and Webster and Hudson. Had a lot of conversations with a lot of people to figure out what concerns are sort of rising to the top for the communities around northern Wisconsin, and what people are looking for out of representation. And this is at a time when Congressman Tom Tiffany was basically missing in action. He was not holding public events. Some of these really momentous decisions, like the big billionaire's bill that came out of Washington that he voted for, he simply wasn't willing to stand up and account for himself in public. And we learned a lot from those trips, and it really helped me, after a lot of thought, make a decision that I think the time is right to stand up and make the case for new representation in Congress in northern Wisconsin.
So you're in.
I'm in. The candidacy starts today.
All right. It's you've done some of the prep work already. There's a website up, clark4wi.com. Again, clark4wi.com, where people are going to learn more about you and more about the issues. I gave a bit of an introduction that stressed your forestry roots, but you did serve a number of years in the legislature. And so tell us a bit more about, you know, your time there and the priorities that you brought to Madison that you'd now like to bring to Washington.
Sure. Thanks for asking. You know, for many years, I lived in Baraboo, a town in Sauk County, north of Madison. From there, I ran a forestry consulting and contracting business. In fact, one of my very first jobs, my first year in business, was marking timber up here for the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest. But in that work, I just became more and more involved in conservation as well as community leadership. And in 2008, I took a long shot and ran for the state assembly seat that includes the communities of Baraboo and Portage and Montello. Perfect farm and forest country. I'd never had a political background before, but again, it was an opportunity for me to learn more and provide service to an important community that really meant a lot to me. I won a Republican-held seat. I did that with a lot of crossover voters from Republicans and Democrats who knew that it was time for a change and that they could trust me to help represent their values and their interests, even if we didn't agree on every issue. And I learned a tremendous amount from that effort. The most important one being, if you're elected as a representative, it's your job to represent everybody. It doesn't matter how they voted, doesn't matter if they agree with you on everything, but there are lots of issues at home that we all have to work together on if we're gonna be successful. And I took that to heart, and I'll take it to heart for northern Wisconsin.
It certainly seems to be a message that would resonate right now in what is now the ninth hour of a shutdown of the federal government, brought about by an unwillingness by the majority party to negotiate, even though they need Democratic votes to get anything done. So I'm sure with this shutdown, people would be asking, what would you do differently? What is it? What traits would you bring that might make it less likely that we see government shutdowns?
Yeah, the choice of Democrats right now is a very tough one, but I don't fault them for standing up. When you look at the brutal impact on middle class people across this country from a single policy of removing the subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, that's going to affect healthcare for millions of people. This is really their only point of leverage right now, but fundamentally, we've got to relook at how we budget and run the federal government. There is simply no reason that we should be going through this shutdown drama every 4 years when the parties can't agree on the most basic responsibility, which is how to run our governments. So I think we need to relook at the principles and procedures for federal budgeting. And that's the most basic thing we should be expecting from our Congress. We expect that from our state legislature. And for the most part, we get it.
Do the basics of funding then extend to putting a priority on things like healthcare rather than billionaire tax breaks? I guess what I'm saying is, you know, right now, the Democrats in Congress are saying, look, negotiate with us if you need our votes, because we think you've gone too far in these healthcare cuts. And if you want our votes, they've got to be, you know, restored or pared back. And Republicans are even refusing to negotiate. I don't think I have to go very hard to find out whether you think Congress should be taking more of its energy on providing for people's health care than providing for tax cuts for the rich.
It's incredible. You know, healthcare wasn't perfect a year ago. We still had a long way to go to provide the opportunity for basic healthcare for everyone, regardless of income. But the big, beautiful bill, as the president liked to call it, has a massive across-the-board impact on both the Medicaid cuts that are going to affect healthcare for the people who need it the most, as well as the Affordable Care Act subsidy removals, which is going to increase healthcare premiums by up to 75% or more for many people that are on the exchanges and the Affordable Care Act. That's the most massive transfer of wealth to billionaires that's ever occurred in the history of our federal government and our federal budgets. No, it's not acceptable. And no, no one should be voting to support a budget that fails Americans so badly and broadly.
We're talking to Fred Clark, former state assembly rep, who is now the Democratic candidate for Congress in the 7th Congressional District, all across the northern third of Wisconsin here. And let's get to the district itself and the things that proper representation can do for it. You've got an entire platform based on rebuilding the rural economy around, you know, our lakes and our forests and our towns. And we know that Tom Tiffany, as a congressman and prior to that in the state legislature, had the primary goal of getting mines operating in Wisconsin and expanding development that way. Okay, that's one mindset, is mining and development. Where's yours in terms of making sure that the rural economy across northern Wisconsin can be vibrant during your time in office?
Yeah, thanks, Pat. You know, so let's just look at what we have here in the north. The forests, the lakes, the rivers, the farms that make up this kind of piece of our world. You know, this is iconic Wisconsin. When the Department of Tourism wants to sell Wisconsin to out-of-state visitors, the North Woods is one of the major places that they go. If we want to maintain that, which also means maintaining the quality of life and the clean water and the clean air and the outdoor spaces that make this place what it is, we have to invest in that. From an economic development standpoint, we can chase big mines, you know, big holes in the ground. We can chase massive international businesses that we think are going to plop down, you know, big data centers and create jobs. But I think time after time and a lot of effort and experience has shown that you get a better bang for your buck by investing in local communities, local businesses, the sort of small and medium-sized businesses and the small farms and the forestry enterprises that are the bulk of employment and economic activity in northern Wisconsin. That's where we need to be making our investments. And as a policymaker, that's where I would absolutely reinvest and increase our investment to make sure that the businesses that are already here are able to thrive.
What about in terms of the trade war that Donald Trump has imposed on this country and on this economy, ostensibly to rebuild help out American manufacturing? To what degree do you feel like that is the right track or wrong track?
Oh, if you talk to farmers today, you know, throughout the Midwest, but including in Wisconsin, the trade war and this sort of ever-changing tariff war that, especially with China right now, is going to be a punch in the gut for farm producers. You know, if you're growing soybeans right now, you may have had a bumper crop this year and nowhere to go with it because China stopped buying American soybeans this year for the first time in a long time. And there simply are not markets for what we're producing today as we get near harvest time. And, you know, farmers have paid their own dollars in these checkoff funds for decades that have gone into marketing programs to help establish these markets. They're being wiped away by a tweet from our president who decides with almost no evidence that we're going to just start these tariff wars. It's hugely disruptive, but we're all going to be paying for it.
The problem is that we've had a Congress that has abandoned its duties as a co-equal branch of government to provide some oversight, some guidance and things like that. And so I want to talk to you after the break about, you know, the role that you think Congress should have if Democrats were to take control in the midterms for the second half of President Trump's term. What are the things that could be done if not working with the president, then at least putting forth, you know, a better slate of ideas than what we've seen and the damage that has been done to the economy right now. We're talking to Fred Clark, former state assembly rep, who is also now a candidate for Congress in the 7th Congressional District here up north. We'll have more with Fred Clark and some final news and notes from Lake Wissota coming up in just a bit. Again, remember, you can follow my work over at upnorthnewswi.com. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back at 7:35. A reminder of our keyword for this morning's early edition of the Go for the Green and Gold Text to Win contest. Early edition because that's the keyword, early, E-A-R-L-Y. Use the Civic Media app and text us the word early before 8 o'clock, and you will be entered for the daily prize drawing, which is cash and some gold jewelry. And every entry can get you the grand prize, tickets to see Green Bay play Minnesota, play some football in Green Bay in November, some nice indoor seats available. Details at civicmedia.us. But again, before 8 o'clock, text us the word early, then you'll have more chances to win, starting with Matt Nair on air at 9 o'clock here across the Civic Media Radio Network. Let's talk a bit about cybersecurity here, and we'll talk about it from a few different standpoints, things that we can do personally, but especially things that businesses can do to provide security for themselves, but frankly, for their reputation as well, and maybe what our government leaders could be doing in an age where AI, artificial intelligence, is becoming more and more prevalent, and provides a lot of opportunities. It also provides a lot of risks that we need to know about. Raul Pavar is with RedSift. He has a rather fascinating resume in high-tech development and security. Folks would recognize part of his early work as part of the founding team and the principal technical architect for Shazam back in 2000, building the first Shazam iPhone app alongside other systems that are related to music recognition and more. And then along with other roles over the years, he now has a cybersecurity company, RedSift, as part of his personal dedication to making the internet safer. And he joins us this morning to talk about AI and, again, keeping ourselves as safe as possible when we're online. Raul Pavar, good morning. Thank you for being here today.
Hey, good morning, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you here. And like I said, you have a lot of experience that you've now dedicated toward internet safety, and a lot of your work is geared on the business side. So we will come to the personal side and maybe the government side as well. But from a business standpoint, the thing that jumped out at me was the way that a lot of what's letting bad individuals in and work on things like, you know, phishing emails and things are when companies have what are called forgotten subdomains that were mistakenly left in their systems and that other, you know, other actors can take advantage of. So it sounds like you're really specializing in ways that businesses are unwittingly providing avenues for bad actors to come in and do things to the business or to their customers. Do I understand that correctly?
Yeah, that's right. I think most of your listeners would probably recognize the fact that there is an awful lot of phishing and fraud and impersonation going on online, whether that's, you know, from their banking partners, their healthcare providers. And this is actually happening all around the world. And that's mainly driven by a couple of things. And one of them is that organizations have a really hard time getting their hands around all of this infrastructure that they now have out on the internet that's communicating with their customers, with their supply chains. And bad actors are looking for all kinds of weaknesses that they can use to impersonate that organization, abuse that trust and relationship that they developed with their customers and the general public, and use that for, you know, some sort of nefarious activity.
And the reason that that's important, well, one of many though, is that it doesn't take much for trust to be violated if you're a business, a small business, big business, whatever the case, that, you know, you may have thought that you had nothing to do with, you know, a phishing campaign that uses your company's name, but your company's name can get besmirched in a hurry nowadays.
Yeah. I mean, in most surveys that are conducted, you know, roughly 75% of customers will cut ties with a brand after a major cyber incident. And many of those customers will actually blame the company, not the attackers, ironically enough, for, you know, not keeping the house in order or basically not having the securities that are required to prevent these types of attacks from being effective. In some cases, that is unfair. I mean, a lot of organizations do have, you know, are under an enormous amount of strain, and cyber attackers are looking for any kind of weakness that they can find. But the reality is that, you know, these things happen, and when they happen, the impact of that can be quite significant.
We're talking to Rahul Pawar. He's the founder of RedSift, an internet security company, about AI and deepfakes and phishing expeditions and things like that. And so let's talk not so much about the big businesses. A lot of them, well, they're aware of things. They have their own challenges. And certainly I know as a legislator, once upon a time, you know, working with state government, and I was blown away at the statistics on just how many attacks any given corporate system is getting on any given day that you have to fend off. But apart from government and big business, when you look at some of these, you know, medium-sized businesses, however you want to define them, I'm sure that it's one thing they didn't think that they'd have to think about, and probably to them sounds like, I don't want to say an unnecessary expense, but I'm sure they wonder about the return on investment. So when you're working on businesses that aren't, you know, say in the Fortune 500, what do you tell them about the need to make those investments in the cybersecurity of their business?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So naturally, I'm a technologist, so, you know, I feel pretty comfortable with technology. But there are lots of businesses, you know, all the way from, you know, regional banks and healthcare providers to, you know, someone who runs an e-commerce shop online in their particular niche. A lot of those businesses don't realize that they're actually pretty digital today, because they acquire customers through digital channels, they manage their internal systems of HR and payroll and their banking systems, all of that online, really, in 2025. So many businesses just haven't gotten around the mindset that actually, whether, you know, whatever they may have done, you know, over the last 100 years, these days, a lot of their risk is actually in the digital domain. And this is particularly true of those medium-sized businesses, those regional businesses that are out there. And they need to think about their cybersecurity, their internet security, in very much the same way as they think about their physical security. And the way they rationalize those physical security investments, they've got to extend that to the digital domain, because the impact of getting it wrong over there is actually pretty significant for everyone today.
Well, and that's where, in looking at your website, redsift.com, I took note of, you know, the need to fight AI with AI. The note here says, effective defense requires AI tools that can scan the full attack surface, detect deepfakes and lookalike domains, prioritize the most dangerous threats, and drastically cut the need for manual triage workloads. That's a very, you know, in-depth way of saying it used to be really easy to spot phishing. I mean, people still fell for it, but it was, you know, dear customer and things like that. And now, essentially, because they're using AI, you're saying AI has to be part of the toolkit for fighting the worst tools that AI can put out there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, about 10 years ago, most people would train their employees that, you know, if you want to spot phishing, look for misspellings, look for bad English. Nowadays, pretty much every bad actor has access to some sort of AI that's going to bang out perfect personalized English for, you know, to target the target end customers. There's going to be AI that's going to spin up websites that will look exactly like your bank, exactly like your healthcare provider, except all the links and buttons that point to various types of nefarious services. So this is really being industrialized and superpowered through the use of AI. And I think it's unrealistic to expect, you know, society, really, businesses, governments to fight this with just pure human capital. It just isn't a very scalable solution. So us and, you know, a whole bunch of other businesses are out there trying to put AI tools into the hands of the defenders so that they can address some of these challenges in the same level of efficiency and scale that the attackers have access to today.
So again, fighting AI with AI, you know, again, you want to be fighting against, you know, hackers and others on a level playing field. Is there anything in the notion of policy that either, you know, a federal government like Congress or state governments at the legislative level, are there things that they can do to improve the situation as well? Or at this point, is public policy essentially powerless when you've got this much high tech, you know, that's already floating out there, changing and evolving every day?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I don't think there's a short answer to that, but I'll try my best. There are a whole bunch of technical solutions that are out there that can keep the general public safe. And a few of them have actually been mandated. So, you know, there's some federal legislation that requires organizations to keep an inventory of all their digital assets, to implement certain protocols that help harden this attack surface against this type of impersonation. But it's quite limited in scope. It only hits, you know, certain types of organizations that are critical national infrastructure or federal government itself. I think rolling that out to, you know, as you mentioned before, the thousands and thousands of mid-market businesses that are out there that handle sensitive data like healthcare or financial data, those sorts of organizations should also probably have some sort of requirement to do the minimum that is required to stay secure online today. But that's taking a long time to really go through at any level of scale.
We're talking to Rahul Pawar from RedSift about AI and cybersecurity. We have spent a lot of time on, you know, the email and the phishing end of things. So many people are vulnerable to just clicking on the wrong thing, trusting an email too much. But from the standpoint of AI, there's also what's being done with deep fakes in terms of video and audio, but especially video. There was a report over the weekend about President Trump apparently essentially responding to a video that turned out to be a deep fake video. And I guess there are people that would want to throw up their hands and say, well, I can't believe anything I see if I can't trust that, you know, a video isn't a deep fake. But I don't think the answer is to throw your computer in the garbage. can you help us try to navigate an era of deep fakes and try to be more mindful or just eternally cynical about what we see?
Yeah, I think for now, eternally cynical is a reasonable default setting when you're browsing the internet or media. I mean, to be fair, people don't fully understand just how easy and how effective the tools are today to generate these types of, you know, still images and video. I mean, everyone appreciates that AI models can generate some pretty compelling text, but the technology has evolved so rapidly over the last year and year and a half that you can pretty much generate very, very convincing looking deepfakes based on, you know, a voice clone or an image of another person. So I think, you know, making sure that you do your research, check the background, don't trust everything that you see online, because it is extremely straightforward and easy for a bad actor to produce something that's very visually compelling in a very short space of time. I am optimistic that the technology will get better. I think we're getting better at detecting some of this stuff now. And so now over time, I expect it'll be easier for us to identify what is, you know, quote unquote real and what is not. But this is an arms race that's live at the moment.
Oh, very much so. And so folks could learn more over at redsift.com. That's R-E-D-S-I-F-T, redsift.com/resource-center. And is there any other final quick words for people individually to feel at least a little bit better about how to navigate the online world these days?
Yeah, I think individually choices are limited because ultimately it's down to the organizations to really harden their attack surface and make it more difficult and more expensive for the bad actors to do this. But I would recommend that individuals stay paranoid when, especially when they're looking at text messages and emails. You know, if your bank suddenly asks you to do something really unexpected at a really unexpected time, it's likely to be a fake.
Exactly. Rahul Povar, thank you very much for the visit and for the advice. It's much appreciated. Thanks for spending some time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right. And again, redsif.com is the website to go to on that. We'll be talking to author Laura Bird and a fire teacher from Ellsworth over her comments about the Charlie Kirk killing. That's all coming up yet. I'm Pat Kreitlow. This is the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.